The general theme is playing in the Psalms. And I use the word playing because I want to get the sense of rolling around, getting absorbed in it. And I want you to kind of do away with the sacred awe that you have for Scripture in order to sense the struggle, the faith, the encounter of the person with God. I have this feeling, and it may not be true, but it's a feeling, that so often we put the Scripture and its words into a kind of a fine china category, and we're afraid to use it, we're afraid to throw it around, we're afraid to get in touch with it. And I invite you to think of the Psalms as kind of like an old hunk of china that helps you enjoy yourself with a cup of coffee, and at the end of the coffee, if you get angry with your husband or wife, just throw it at them, you know, because all of those emotions are a part of the Psalms. Yesterday, we talked about Psalm 104, and Psalm 104 is a thing of beauty. The psalmist goes on a vacation. He hikes up to Holden Lake. He drinks in the beauty there. He catches a few fish, and with his belly filled with good berries, he comes back and doesn't even work up a blister and hardly an ache in his muscles, sits down and writes about it, lyrics of praise. It's a beautiful kind of an experience. And when you think about it, it's one of those, how beautiful and calm and peaceful experiences. That was yesterday. The Psalms that I want to deal with today are really disaster. The psalmist sits with his community. Some sort of an emergency, some sort of a crisis calls the people together. Everything has gone wrong. You know, it's worse than an accident on the hike with no doctor in the village. It's worse than it's having rained all over your picnic and ruined the outdoor eating. It's worse than two blisters, one right on top of the other. It's worse than finding no berries. God is gone. That's how bad it is. The people believe that God is gone or asleep, silent, not paying any attention to their difficulties. And their whole faith system is shaken. It's rattled. It's distorted. It's tested. Everything they believed about God seems to be up for grabs. And the community sits in lament. The community sits crying. Officially, the Psalms are called community lament Psalms. Most commentators use that kind of terminology. But I've chosen this morning to deal with two Psalms. The thing says three, but three was too many. We'll deal with two, and I call them Psalms for a worried nation. Psalms for a worried nation. The first one is Psalm 44. In your hymnal, it's page 234. 234. Psalm 44. I'm going to read through it and invite you to follow along in the text. I'll make some comments, not a whole lot. I think you can capture the meaning. And you may even be surprised at the boldness of the psalmist as he sits in his community in speaking against God. Envision, if you will, something having happened. I don't know. Could have been a plague. Could have been starving. Could have been enemies coming in. Could have been raids from foreign countries to carry away the crops. All kinds of things that are common in the experience of the early Israel. And in the light of that kind of an emergency, there's sort of a pattern of extemporaneous crisis worship experiences. When something bad happens, some kind of a call goes out, and the tribes come together, the community of faith comes together, and sits in its place of worship and cries about it, and pleads to God for some kind of health and assistance. And it help and assistance, and it reviews its faith. It reviews the foundation of its stance with God. That kind of thing has happened. And as the people are gathered together, much like we're gathered together here, coming from all over, we gather together in Psalm 44, they say, "We have heard with our ears, O God, our forefathers have told us, the deeds you did in their days, in the days of old." Could be that Grandpa told them, Daddy or Mom told them about all the marvelous things that God has done. Could be that somebody stood up and read a little bit of a liturgy in their meeting, a passage out of the scriptures that had been recorded at that time, something like that, telling about the marvelous acts of God. All right, we've heard it, they say. "How with your hand you drove the peoples out and planted our forefathers in the land, how you destroyed nations and made your people flourish." Out of Egypt, maybe, into Promised Land, into Canaan. We've heard about this. It was marvelous. It was wonderful. Verse 3. Notice how it happened. "They did not take the land by their sword, nor did their arm win the victory for them, but your right hand, your arm, and the light of your countenance, because you favored them. You are my king and my God. You command victories for Jacob." See, they've had a good time. "Through you, we pushed back our adversaries. Through your name, we trampled on those who rose up against us. For I did not rely on my bow, and my sword does not give the victory. Surely you gave us victory over our adversaries and put those who hate us to shame. Every day we gloried in God, and we will praise your name forever." Catch the sense of that. If you read through the whole Old Testament, you find that the whole stance of the Jewish faith is that God does it. Sometimes the Jew seems stupid and ridiculous in his own actions, but God still gives the victory. If people find ascriptions to Assyrian kings or Babylonian monarchs and stuff, usually there is all kinds of praise heaped on the king. It's very different for the testimony and the faith recollection of Israel. All of the praise goes to God. All of the praise goes to God. And there it is. You did it. You did it. Not our swords, not our power. You did it. That's the history of our past. All kinds of marvelous things have happened to us, and God did it. Great. Comes verse 9. That's the past. Verse 9 begins the present. "Nevertheless, you have rejected and humbled us. Do not go forth with our armies. You have made us fall back before our adversaries, and our enemies have plundered us. You have made us like sheep to be eaten, and have scattered us among the nations. You are selling your people for a trifle, and are making no profit on the sale of them." That's terrific imagery. God, you've always been so good for us. Now the bottom has fallen out, and it's like you've sold us for nothing. Now, what do you got to gain? What are you getting out of this, God? Now, what advantage is there for you in all of our hardship and all of our difficulty? It's a why question. Why is all of this misery happening to us? They're embarrassed. Verse 13. "You have made us the scorn of our neighbors, a mockery and derision to those around us. You have made us a byword among the nations, a laughingstock among the peoples. My humiliation is daily before me, and shame has covered my face because of the taunts of the mockers and blasphemers, because of the enemy and avenger." We are the people who proclaim your name. We are the people who believe in God. All those non-believers and pagans around us are laughing at us. They say, "Ha ha, you got a great God. Look at what he's doing for you." "All this has come upon us. We have not forgotten you, nor have we betrayed your covenant. Our heart never turned back, nor did our footsteps stray from your path. Though you thrust us down into a place of misery and covered us over with deep darkness, if we have forgotten the name of our God or stretched out our hands to some strange God, will not God find it out? for he knows the secrets of our heart. Indeed, for your sake we are killed all the day long. We are accused as sheep for the slaughter. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter. Awake, O Lord. Why are you sleeping? Arise. Do not reject us forever. That is not a pile of phony sense of we're good. That's a self-examination. They are saying we don't deserve it. All that we're getting, we do not deserve. We've been faithful to you. We have not broken the covenant. If we had broken the covenant, if we had been a rotten bunch of sinners around here, if we had reached out to all kinds of pagan gods, then we could understand the kind of difficulty and misery that we've got coming here. But we haven't done that. We have been loyal, and I believe it. I don't want to question that. It is a sincere statement that these people are making. They have been faithful to the covenant, and still the bottom has fallen out. Here's their question. Why have you hidden your face and forgotten our affliction and our oppression? We sink down to the dust. Our body cleaves to the ground. And it's that kind of desperate cry of faith. Rise up and help us and save us for the sake of your love. Steadfast love, chesed. That's the covenant relationship. God has steadfast, never-ending love. And the people are saying that's all we got to bank on. But it looks as if that steadfast love stopped. Want to look at the next psalm right away. It's the same kind of a picture. But do you capture the misery of it? God, you've been terrific in the past. But today is a blast. Why? We don't deserve it. How come? That why question. But the final plea, their only plea, rise up, help us. In your love, help us. Turn to Psalm 80. It's on page 252. This one isn't quite as long. It's as good. I can identify with these psalms. Hear, O Shepherd of Israel, leading Joseph like a flock, shine forth you that are enthroned upon the cherubim. Again, it's the tribes of Joseph. It doesn't need to be dated in terms of time. Kind of a specific group of people, probably the northern kingdom, but that's not essential. Praising God. Here's this cherubim language. It's almost like the opening of, hymnal phrases. Praises of God, how you were taught to make the right approach to God, addressing God. And they're doing that. They're speaking to God who's enthroned upon the cherubim. In the presence of Ephraim, Benjamin, and Manasseh, stir up your strength and come to help us. Here maybe we have an identification of specific tribes out of Israel that are gathered together in the worship. Here we are from Ohio and Minnesota and Pennsylvania. We come, we got a common kind of a problem. Stir up your strength and come to help us. Restore us, O God of hosts. Show the light of your countenance and we shall be saved. That restore us, O God of hosts, is a kind of almost liturgical refrain that we see repeated three times in the psalm here. Maybe that's a congregational kind of reaction, sort of a liturgical response. Could be, but that's really the basic plea. Restore us, O God of hosts. Show the light of your countenance and we shall be saved. Verse 4 is the question. O Lord of hosts, how long will you be angered despite the prayers of your people? How long? How long? We're in trouble, we're rejected. We're going to see a little bit more about the problems a little bit later on. We've got misery. You have fed them, your people, with the bread of tears and have given them bowls of tears to drink. That's imagery. What we're eating, God, is tears. What we're drinking, God, is tears. Our basic sustenance is total misery. You have, here again, this embarrassment. You have made us the derision of our neighbors, and our enemies laugh us to scorn. Here we are, your people again. People who proclaim your good name, and you're really embarrassing us, God. Verse 7, that strophe again, restore us, O God of hosts. Show the light of your countenance, and we shall be saved. Now here's a nice little, almost an allegory, about the vine, and we've seen this vine imagery all over. It's in New Testament and Old Testament. You have, verse 8 and on, you have brought a vine out of Egypt. You cast out the nations and planted it. You prepared the ground for it. It took root and filled the land. You know, it's like out of Egypt, out of the captivity in Egypt, comes this plant, and it's planted in the promised land, and it grows there. Notice how it grows up into the mountains. It becomes a kind of a nation that encompasses the mountains. Verse 10, the mountains are covered by its shadow. And it reaches into the cedars of Lebanon, which is the beautiful forested area a little north, and the towered cedar trees by its boughs. You stretched its tendrils to the sea and its branches to the river. Sea coasts become part of the nation and the prosperous rivers. Then verse 12. Why have you broken down its wall so that all who pass by pluck off its grapes? Again, that imagery of the vineyard that has become a nation with walls around the vineyard, but now the walls are shattered, and everybody who wants to just comes by and plucks off the grapes, the riches of the nation. The wild boar of the forest has ravaged it, verse 13. The beasts of the field have grazed upon it. You know, the deer are coming in, eating our flowers. It's worse than that. Then the plea again. Turn now, O God of hosts. Look down from heaven. You're gone. You're far away. Look down from that faraway place. Behold and tend this vine. Preserve what your right hand has planted. These enemies burn it like rubbish. But at the rebuke of your countenance, let them perish. Now, they have been destroyed, and it would be so easy for God to rebuke all those enemies and restore the people. Verse 16 and 17, or verse 16 primarily, visions the nation kind of as one people, one individual at the right hand of God, and all the bad guys are on the other side, the enemies. So let your hand be upon the man at your right hand, the Son of Man you have made so strong for yourself. And so will we never turn away again, turn away from you. Give us life, that we may call upon your name. Then the final repeating of this plea, restore us, O Lord God of hosts. Show the light of your countenance, and we shall be saved. It's the same story as in Psalm 44, said a little differently. Problems are probably a little different. It's a little different community expressing its agony, but the pattern is pretty much the same. A testimony to all that God has done, a realization that in the present it looks like he isn't doing a darn thing. Most of the agony and the punishment is sensed as being undeserved, and I think it is. Undeserved in terms of human logic. And a desperate plea to God, a dependence upon God's love, God's steadfast love for their well-being. They have nothing else to reach for. I'd like to make a couple of comments, and but I think the Psalms speak for themselves. I think we have no trouble identifying with some of the agony of the Psalms, but of these two Psalms, but I want to make sure that you grasp the real agony in the Psalm, the real test of faith in the Psalms. First of all, it's important to notice that all of the glory goes to God. In every thing that they recall in terms of their past history. They give all of the credit to God. That's an important point. I already alluded to this. The test in the psalm, the test of faith, is not motivated because of physical agony. The test of faith in these two psalms is over a rattling of their whole theological system. A rattling of their whole theological system. Their sort of worldview of faith is in question. And I think that is the more difficult thing with which to deal. If your arm is broken, or your bunions hurt, or your wealth is gone, you face some kind of crisis. But if your theological system, if your faith system, if your expectations about God seem to be shattered, that's probably the worst thing that an individual can endure. They rehearse everything that God has done. And in the 44th Psalm, they come to this question, why? God, what good are you getting out of our misery? What good are you getting out of your misery, out of our misery? Doesn't make a bit of sense. Why is this happening? And in Psalm 80, the question is, how long is this misery going to happen? And in Psalm 80, in the 12th verse, they ask the question, why there too? Why have you broken down its wall? You know, the city, this marvelous place that we had. Why is the whole business falling apart? In both Psalms, the misery is undeserved. In 44, I alluded to this, they say, we have been faithful to the covenant. We even invite your examination, God. You know, if we had been unfaithful, you would know it. We can't hide anything from you. And we want you to look and see if we've been unfaithful. We haven't been. We've kept the commandments and the covenant, and we've prayed and all that kind of business, and yet this still happens to us. In the 80th Psalm, I made a point of saying they addressed God properly. They were engaged in prayer. And in spite of that, they seemed to be incurring nothing but the wrath of God. And it wasn't because they were praying wrong. They were praying right. Their whole system of piety, their whole system of worship, wasn't working. And they were scared. I want to repeat this. The test to the faith of these people was not that they were being conquered, but the fact that they were being conquered tested their whole belief system. You know, they believed that God would bless them if they kept the covenant. And they were keeping the covenant, and they were being plundered and overrun. Still, it's quite clear, isn't it? Still, in spite of the punishment, the misery, which is the minor problem, the double blisters on the heels, in spite of that, and in spite of the fact that everything that they were taught and believed about God was now up for grabs, in spite of all of that, they still believed in God. They still put all of their confidence and trust in God. These kind of sort of zingers, and then let's open it up for conversation. I hear often, and you have probably said, and I think I've said it myself, and the people in the psalm say it, we don't deserve this. What in the name of heaven is God doing? We don't deserve it. The people in the psalm remained faithful even with that question. We probably changed churches. They thought they were okay. They thought they had everything figured out about God. They thought they knew what should happen and what would happen if they were faithful. But they discover that their whole system of presuppositions is wrong, and they are surprised. God doesn't do what they expect him to do. They believed anyhow. We don't really like that kind of God who doesn't match our expectations. I want to say this so that it doesn't seem derogatory of youth, but it comes up time and time again in work in the university, and I heard the questions before I got to the university. The young person who thinks they are making a profound discovery, they say, how can a God of love let that happen? How can a God of chesed, steadfast love, allow hunger and all this kind of stuff to happen in the world? Now, they almost think, as if this is what I have trouble not smiling, they almost think if they are that they're the first ones to make that discovery, you know, that something's wrong. And if God allows that kind of stuff to happen, I'm not going to believe in that kind of God. The people in the Psalms thought that God was crazy, that God allowed stupid things to happen. And the Psalm people asked the question, why does God let this happen? They believed anyhow. They believed anyhow. In the Apostles' Creed, we confess together very boldly, I believe in God the Father, Creator. We confess, I believe in Jesus Christ, Redeemer. I believe in the Holy Spirit, Giver of gifts. Now we've got a lot of things that are there and positive and for sure. The psalmists here, the psalm mentality here is adding kind of a fourth article. We believe when God does nothing. We believe when God is silent. We believe when it looks like God is even fallen asleep. And you always got to have a zinger. You know, you always got to have a killer in the midst of a place like this. But when the nation worried, the Psalm nation, and its security was threatened, it put greater trust in God. When our nation worries, when its security is threatened, builds a bigger bomb. That's my talk. Go.
One thing about this that kind of bothers me a little bit, as compared to what we think and the way we act today. I think it was in verse 4 of 80, sort of about humming me. It says, O Lord God of hosts, how long will you be angered despite the prayers of your people? I mean, it says that the reason we're having trouble is because God's mad at us. And we say today, I mean, in fact, it's been quoted a weekend several times, you know, plant the apple tree. What these Psalms are saying, to me anyway, is that if your apple tree dies, it's God's angry with you, and unless God changes his mind, don't do anything. I mean, it's a very passive couple of Psalms, it seems like. That we shouldn't be active, we shouldn't try and change the world because God's angry. Until our prayers are answered and God is no longer angry, we have to wait for God's time.
Do you get that feeling, or is there another way to speak to that?
Yeah, I'm sure I'm wrong.
Yeah, no. Not only did the Israelite believe that all of his blessings came from God, but he believed that all of his miseries came from God. He didn't have any trouble with that as long as he thought he deserved the misery. Where he had terrible problems was when he was faithful. Well, they prayed their hearts out. And they tried to make sure that their prayers, you know, were sincere and from deep within and used all the proper theological addresses and that kind of thing. And still, it seemed to them as if God was angry. That's what I'm trying to say is the misery of faith. And the why is God angry, even though we're praying and doing everything God wants us to do, you know, we're asking. We're trying, we're doing it all right. I forgot where I was going, help me. What happened there?
My thought in this comment about being passive is actually it's very active, because unlike our present frame of mind, these people argue with God. And therefore it's very active arguing with God, okay, you know, you're mad at us, but why? You know, and arguing back and forth, trying to change God's.
This is the same trap a lot of people get into, I think, today, that when troubles come to them, they assume that they've done something wrong to anger God. You know, I've been a good Christian all my life, why is this happening to me, type of thing.
Right.
And they get into very deep despair that way, and this is what's happening here.
But they don't argue with God.
And if it keeps happening, well, they argue with God today. People that feel this way say, why is that happening to me? I've done this and this and this for you, God. Why are you angry with me? I mean, I'm hopeless without you, and I'm not going to help myself. I'm mad at me. I've obviously sinned grievously, and please do something for me. Not to say, give me the strength to overcome this, and let me turn things around with your help. You know, it's kind of bothers me. These couple times, it's
bother me too.
I'm a little bit bothered by your willingness to accept the psalmist's statement that I've not deserved your deserting me. All the prophetic writings throughout the various sages, and I have a little trouble with the chronological sequence into which the psalm fits and the different prophetic writings fit, but the prophets are always telling Israel that you are going to bring it on yourself, or you have brought it on yourself. The psalmist is an apologist for the people.
In these psalms.
Yes.
There are also penitential psalms.
Yes.
Now, where there is that same kind of a prophetic confession.
I mean, starting from what we know of the prophetic writings, it seems like the psalmist in these particular psalms is trying to con God into thinking the people have been better than in fact they have been.
I don't think this is happening, and I think they're in these psalms, and I want to be charitable to the people. I know another good illustration that is the same experience of the psalmist. And it's the illustration of a good friend of ours who hung on a cross. And at least the way that story is recorded in Mark, when Jesus hangs on the cross, his desperate plea is what? My God, why have you forsaken me? And that's really where Mark ends. Jesus has had it. You know, he just doesn't know. God is gone. God is silent. God is absent. But does Jesus lose faith? Did Jesus deserve to be abandoned by God? If the situation of the Psalms is traumatic. It's much easier to understand the misery if you can point to a weakness or a sin or a fault in the people or in ourselves. But to deal with that kind of a theological system that says we don't have God in our pocket, that when we think we know if we do it right, God will do it right too. These psalms say, we've been doing it right, and it's not coming out right, and that is hard to live with. That is real crisis, that is real agony of your whole system. It wasn't the pain to their bodies that tested their faith. It was the pain to their psyche, their whole system, their whole theology that was the real test of faith. And they still remained faithful. Is the psalm strange to you? Is it not your experience?
I would like to know if there's a psalm that's a follow-up of this, how it comes out. Of these particular two, you know.
No, there isn't. And the psalms don't answer the question. And you know, it's the same kind of experience that Job has. All these things happen to Job. And some of Job's friends say to him, come on, Job, sit down here and let's try to figure out what you did to deserve it. And Job says what the psalmist did. I didn't. Job says there's something wrong with God, not me. He didn't say that, but that's certainly the implication. And it ends up with that mystery. You know, God knows what it is and what's going on. And, you know, God just doesn't meet our expectations all this time. God is something else.
How are we to apply this today, though? Can we ever hope to be a Christian nation that says, God, we're doing everything right, and you're abandoning us if the projections are true for the next generation? I don't think we could ever get ourselves in this position again.
I don't know about getting us into this position. I think we're in this position all the time.
I mean, as a nation, though. I mean, it's pretty easy for us to look and say, well, it's obvious why things are so bad, and we don't really live a Christian life as a nation.
No, I think it's impossible to interpret the psalm or deal with the psalm in terms of nation, but in terms of faith communities, belief communities. I think there we can experience the kind of agony of this psalm. And what you learn from the psalm is your humanness before God. As long as you can package God, you don't have much trouble. See, like yesterday, I said yesterday was fun. Here you got all this creation and the beautiful lyrics and the marvel, and your whole system is in order, there's nice tranquility, and everything fits together. Today it's shattered. Nothing works. Nothing they believed works. Yet still the people put their confidence in God.
What weren't the disciples kind of faced with this when Jesus was crucified? Their whole system was shattered.
Yep.
And I became aware, I think I'm saying this accurately, that Jesus prayed for the strengthening of their faith shortly before the crucifixion. Is this a means for strengthening faith, these blank periods, difficult periods?
I'm going to answer that question in a way that it doesn't become a system by simply saying, I don't know, or it could be. That's part of our problem, I think, that we want to turn everything into a system. I'm afraid that we've done that with the cross. The cross means that the cross of Jesus is you suffer a little bit and then you'll have good glory. And so the cross is simply a process through which you get to something better. You can't be sure. The cross may be the way it ends. But you believe in God anyhow. That's what the psalmist did. May never get better. I hope that's not evasive. But again, I don't want to develop some kind of an expectation. You can say, well, I'm going to have to suffer and endure a little while, but surely it'll get better. It may not. And if it doesn't, are you going to say, to hell with you, God? The people in the Psalms didn't. We're going to turn to something else? Some other God? Now, that's what we are prone to do. But the faith of these people is such that in spite of everything, they hang on to God. How shall I interpret your silence?
Well, I'm still puzzled, I guess. I still get back to the same comment before. That it sounds like that if troubles happen, we should passively accept troubles and pray to God that they'll change. But we shouldn't try and help God change things on earth. In other words, you use the example of the bomb being built. We should say, well, that's God's will. And if it blows up the earth, we say, well, we're suffering because God's so angry with us. Please, God, let this thing end. But don't make me do anything about it, though. Or if you're starving in the world, don't change the system. That's God's will. And those people are supposed to starve because God's angry with them or something. That's what the psalm is saying to me. And I don't think that's right.
I don't like that either. Is that what the psalmist is saying? That you can't do anything about it, or you shouldn't do anything about it, just sit there. The questions that the psalm here the questions being asked. And the faith statement is, the question is, why is this happening? We don't deserve it. And we ask questions too, why is this happening? And very often we can say we know why it's happening. Because of selfishness and all this kind of stuff, we can put our finger on why things are happening and we can try to overcome them. But sometimes even if we know why things are happening and we try to overcome them, they're still out of hand and we still can't accomplish change. We still can't bring things under control. We face up to our human limitations, and the only resort we have really is complete dependence upon God. And it is not to resort to other kinds of dependencies, whether it be our own abilities or the capabilities of science or the power of the bomb. These people didn't resort to anything for sure but God.
Faith not works.
It's one way of saying it, but faith and works.
But not, the Psalms here is not leaning on anything but faith.
In the face of hopelessness, yes.
In this day and age, we are never going to get to the point where we could say, well, God, we're doing everything we can,
right?
Because we just aren't. We've done that all week, how the churches aren't addressing the problems. I mean, maybe they can, maybe it's so big we can't do it. So I see us looking at and saying, well, this is a very, very imperfect world, and it's not a bit surprising that things are heading the way they're heading, because man is making it happen. Or, you know, man is not trying to live according to God's law.
Yeah. When the psalmist says we're not guilty, the psalmist is not saying, I don't think, that we're doing everything right, like our vocations and our marriages and our raising of children. He's not implying that we are perfect and doing everything right. I think what he means is in terms of relationship to God, in a covenant relationship that says, I'll be faithful, you be faithful. You know, and God doesn't expect perfection in that relationship. They were righteous people. They were doing their cultic duties. You know, they were doing what was prescribed for them in their religious setting. That is the extent, I think, of their ability to say we've been doing it right. And so we say, you know, we're praying and we're believing and we're going to Sunday school and we worship and we give our offering. Our cultic expressions, all of these things are faithful. We can try to be that way toward God. But in spite of that faithfulness, it looks like God isn't keeping his end of the bargain. But we believe that he will anyhow. Yeah, it's certainly not a total kind of perfection.
No, I like the term in terms of human logic. They thought they were doing the things. Yeah. But I think that there's you know, they were operating almost a theocracy, weren't they?
Yeah.
We're operating,
at that time, these human relations problems and all that, they didn't really see as part of their relationship to God in the sense that we do today, did they?
Well, I think early in the history they did. There was a real tie between their faith and their worship and their political actions. These lament psalms, for instance, there are only a few of these. There are only a few in the book of Psalms. But the Bible is filled with all these kinds of laments. And apparently, historically, they were the predominant kind of psalm. But by the time the psalms are collected together, the nation is nothing but a tiny little providence that's controlled by bigger powers. And so the relationship between what's happening in the world and what they are doing and can accomplish in their little faith community, they're so remote that they went away from these laments and turned more to penitential kind of things. Just confession. Almost out of a sense of loss of control. It didn't become part of their worship that much anymore. They just confessed.
As you were reading these Psalms, I kept thinking of the Jews in Germany during Hitler's reign. Were they saying these same Psalms to each other, or wondering what's happening to them? And the Jewish people throughout history have always been tortured and pogroms and things like that. To me, I could just see them coming back to Psalm 80 and Psalm 44 saying the same things.
And if I can leave you with a word of comfort as you go away from this thing, it would be something like this. And it's not really a word of comfort. That as Lutherans or as Christians, we have lived with some rather clear definitions of God, with some clear understanding of relationships with God, of some expectations for ourselves and for others and for the community of belief. You know, we've got a system, and we believe that if we participate in that system to some degree of faithfulness, we really understand and have God figured out. If you discover that your system doesn't work, give up on your system. Don't give up on God. Does that make sense? Don't make an idol out of your system. Well, I don't care what it is. Even if it's the Bible that confuses you and makes you want to give up God, don't let that happen. Stick with God and forget your system. Let it be adjusted by the kind of thing that you do or don't experience in terms of God. I think that's the message of these Psalms. And there are times when we come to that place in our lives.